This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai whakaronga mai ki te ao tai whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Ram.
Kia ora and g'day. I'm Duncan Smith.
Today I chat to one of the last of the old-time rabbiters who helped stave off a plague of rabbits on high country farms.
We meet a young couple in Gisborne with ambitions to plant a million trees.
Later on in our feature, hemp in North Canterbury. The harvest can't come soon enough, with hemp seed in high demand.
But first up, our look at conditions on the land. Where in Northland there's a meteorological drought, from the area north of the Bay of Islands through Kaitaia and up to Cape Reinga. Other parts are just extremely dry. If you want water to be delivered, it could take 10 days to arrive. River flows are generally very low compared to long-term averages, but should improve next week, as rain is on the radar. Pastures are dry, but there's food in the bank, with grass, silage and hay stashed away and palm kernel available. Farmers with cull stock are having to wait a bit for space at the works. Around Pukekohe, a bit of rain midweek washed the dust off leaves, but did little to raise soil moisture. Packing sheds are busy bagging onions for Europe and Singapore. Prices are said to be okay. However, with congestion at the Port of Auckland, getting the containers on the wharf and onto an available ship is frustrating. Out in the field, overcast skies and cooler air temperatures have been ideal for planting winter greens. These are becoming much more expensive to grow due to higher labour costs and plant protection products which are not always available.
Waikato is trucking steadily into a drought. For the year, it's 300 millimetres of rain short. There was rain this week, but it was very patchy, from 3 millimetres in Hamilton to 16 in Reporoa. To make a difference, 100 is needed. Feed is getting quite tight on most farms, but there's supplementary feed on hand. Milk production's dropping rapidly in the dry, hot conditions, and maize crops are starting to suffer too, especially those on sandy soils. However, lots of farms planted maize early, and those crops are coming off now, a good 2 to 4 weeks ahead of schedule. Talk of rain is on every farmer's lips in the Bay of Plenty. Whether you've had some or not has been the luck of the draw. Some areas have had 8 millimetres this week and others 50. Follow-up rain forecast for next week will be key. Our contact says for the past 2 years the region's been 250 millimetres short of moisture both years. The regional council's concerned about river levels and farmers are having trouble with wells and springs. Facial eczema spore levels are expected to shoot up now there's been moisture and heat, and farmers are rushing around putting zinc in water lines and boluses in animals.
King Country has a bit of an autumnal feel with cool evening and mornings. 20 millimetres of rain has fallen around Te Kuiti in the past couple of days. On the whole, there's plenty of grass, but some of it is rough and stalky. Lamb prices have held up better than everybody thought, but cattle have been killed at below $5 a kilogram for the first time in a long while. Next week, Te Kuiti's hosting a sale of between 2,000 and 3,000 Wiltshire ewes, the biggest yarding they've had of the breed. With more and more reports of mainline fleece wool selling for less than a dollar a kilogram, there's expected to be huge interest in the sheep that don't need to be shorn. Taranaki's having a cracker summer. The farmer we rang had been waiting for our call and was itching to tell us it's been primo. And as for feed, just fill your boots. Milk production's holding really well and cows are in top order. The one thing letting the region down is that empty rates in cows are a little higher than farmers would like. November was a tricky month for getting cows and calf.
Manawatu and Rangitike are looking good. It's even green, thanks to a bit of rain. Farmers are relieved stock prices are holding. Hawke's Bay's drying out, bores are getting low or going dry, and there are water bans for irrigating from most rivers. The region's had 8 fires in rural areas in the last 10 days. 5 are definitely suspicious. That's a concern given the amount of dry, stalky grass around. The fire at Takapo this week may have been started by a spark from a machine. There's been a little rain on farms tucked into the Tararua range, but eastern Wairarapa is starting to get dry. Farmers are resigned to a hot, dry month ahead, but that's summer in Wairarapa for you. Lambs are coming up to weight very quickly, so there's a stream of them flowing to the works.
The Tasman district received some rain this week, although it's still quite dry around Nelson. Our dairy farmer contact said farmers around him were gearing up to cope with new water policies, getting fencing and other infrastructure sorted. He says they want to get ahead of rules rather than waiting for legislation, and it's good to see the engagement. A few dairy farms have come up for sale and some have already changed hands, so the confidence is there to continue with cows. Apparently, all in all, it's been a good season, but our farmer says he isn't skiting, he's just not complaining. Marlborough's been warm and windy. There has been rain, but it's very variable. Some got 50 millimetres, some 15, and everything in between. The farmer we chatted to has his teaser ram out. The main rams will be out early next week. He likes lambing in mid-July to tie in with help from the grandkids and school holidays. That's the plan anyway. No one is saying they're short of feed yet. One of the earliest ever harvests of Pinot Noir grapes, for bubbles, happened on Thursday in the district. The fruit had reached a Brix level of 19, so they were good to go.
At Karamea on the west coast, farms are dry even though there has been rain, so the grass isn't growing as well as hoped. Apparently it's been a flat season in terms of growth, enough sometimes and not enough at others. Water table levels are going backwards. Dairy farmers are starting to go on to alternative milking times such as 16 hourly. Supplements are being used to keep milk production up. Farmers are keener to use them when the payout is good. It's patchy on farms in North Canterbury. Some haven't had much rain since Christmas and they're showing the effects, especially on coastal hill country right down to Rangiora. But back into the foothills there's been fantastic rain. The difference between the two areas, not that many kilometres apart, is amazing. Crops and cereals are coming in fast now after people thought they'd be delayed because of rain. Suddenly it's warmed up again and things are humming. It's good getting crops off early so green feed can be drilled in again. Farmers are still holding on to store lambs, but as they start to sort ewes out for mating, more are likely to be on offer at the sales. Looking towards winter, farms are on track.
In mid-Canterbury, a good spell of weather means a lot of the harvest has been completed, with wheat, barley and grass seed crops already in. Balers are following on, tidying up the straw. Scanning is underway on dairy farms too. Results so far seem good. Central Otago orchardists are picking nectarines and they're fabulous, apparently. The rain last month that wrecked the cherries and apricots was loved by the plums and nectarines, so there's a plus to that rain too. And the hills are looking very green. Southland had a bit of rain. It was getting dry, so this moisture will get farms through for a while, although some would have liked more. Temperatures have dropped. Fires were even lit this week. Bizarre when last weekend farmers were enjoying the beach. Grass is growing again now.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
We're off to a creek in the high country behind Gisborne now. I'd heard about an enterprising young couple, Willie and Kelsey Hyanger, whose business, Farm Care, is plugging a gap, helping busy farmers plant trees to keep waterways clean and stop erosion. Willie had his backpack sprayer on when I dropped by at the end of last year to find out more about their award-winning startup.
This is a brand new fence. Yeah, they fenced off all this to, so the stock couldn't get into there. And then, we've sort of just planted all along the waterways, about a metre up to the waterways. In this block, there's 3,500 just along here, so it's only a small strip. We've sort of just made sure that it connects to the end and we don't go too far into the water because we don't want the sprays going into the creek.
So tell us where we are, Willie.
At the moment, we're up in Madawai, and there's a whole project, so there's 9 farmers in total and it runs 30k all the way back to Motu, and all these creeks and rivers flow into the Motu River.
And so how much work have you guys done here planting?
At the moment we've planted 30,000 on 9 farms.
30,000 trees.
Yeah, and next year the same 9 farmers and a few more added, it's going to be 80,000 next year.
Huge job.
Yeah, really big job.
Is this one of the biggest jobs that you're involved with?
This one will be, and there's another one down Hawke's Bay where we're putting in a few as well.
And what sort of trees are you putting in?
All sorts, like just all native stuff. So and that are native to the area as well. So we're up in a high country block up here. So there's more sort of manukas and your mingi mingi and stuff like that, whether that's climatised to that sort of area.
A big job doing all this fencing as well. Were you guys involved in that?
Some farmers have their own gear and they've put in their own fences, and we have helped out on a couple farms putting in new fences. It's just something that farmers up here want to do. They want to be seen to, you know, be doing good for the environment. Well, you see all the cow patties around and stuff like that. It stops all that going into the water and stuff like that with the fences, and also a lot of the plants soak up a lot of that as well. So if it does rain and it starts to head down towards the creek, those plants, the roots are going to soak it all up as well.
So today, what's your plan?
Today I'm just going around releasing some. This is the second round of releasing. So,
and what do you mean by releasing?
Just killing all the grass around the plants, just to let the plants have another. Well, this will be the second round, so this will be 2 years of release spraying, and it'll just help them grow and not let the grass smother the plants. In winter, and with all the rainfall, a lot of flooding comes down this side, so we're staying off this side and planting more grasses, flaxes, and the odd trees in between on this side. And then if you look across the creek over there, we've planted a lot more
right,
trees,
yeah.
Where it's sort of steeper.
Oh yes.
So more trees for erosion, and that's a bit more of a bank where when heaps of water comes down, it's not going to wipe out all the trees.
And there's some gorse up there as well, I can see.
Yeah, so that's part of next year's project, is to cut some of that out, take all the gorse out, and they're hoping to plant that hill as well.
So you guys must be really busy doing this sort of work.
Over winter, yeah, it gets really busy, because that's sort of the ideal time to plant natives. So, but we've got a big team. So,
how many guys would you have out here doing the work?
For a job like this, 3,500 would have four guys. Another job, we had 5,000. We took a team of nine out, and yeah, that we blew that out in half a day. So, yeah, we just get stuck in. And yeah.
Where do you get your workers from?
They're
Everyone
all local.
Talks about a labour shortage.
Yeah. They're all local workers, so for the last 2 years we've had a workforce of 80. We'd like to get over 100, but it's just really hard just trying to find more workers.
Do you train them up yourself?
We do provide them with training. A lot of them come with experience in planting, mainly in the forestry side, but we've adapted a different technique to put in these natives, because natives need a lot more care.
What does it feel like to be planting natives as opposed to pine trees?
Well, it's like putting it back to its natural habitat, so I guess it's like more rewarding than planting pine trees. Pine trees leave a lot of mess when they get logged, so you know this is going to be here forever and it's not going to get taken out as well. I've noticed a lot more wildlife starting to show up in this area, from where it was just low short grass to now there's a few more pukeko, well there's and weka, which has come back into this area. Probably in another 5 years you'll see a real big difference.
Do you love your job?
I do love being out here and just being out on the countryside. I've always had a passion for farming. The ultimate goal was to buy a farm, but farms are just worth so much at the moment.
Kelsey, you're also involved in this business, and it seems to have grown hugely over the last few years, and you've won awards for it. Tell me a little bit about how the business has grown.
So we started, or Willie started, he was sort of doing seasonal work. He was doing a bit of forestry planting, and then after that he'd go and do sort of like farmhand jobs. And yeah, and he noticed that there was a shortage of labour for farmers, or someone that, you know, a farmer could call to book in a person to do a job here and there, or come help wean, come help drench. And yeah, and then he thought of the idea to start Farm Care, and from there it's just growing. The horticulture side grew. Yeah, we took on some vet work.
Like sheep scanning?
Yep, sheep scanning.
That's
and drenching
thing.
And
mm-hmm.
capsuling, and then got into the native planting.
And how big a part of the business now is the native planting?
It's quite seasonal, so Over winter, it's probably 30 to 40% of our business. Yeah, then we have pruning and a lot of nursery work as well, helping to grow the next year's plants and stuff like that.
And the farmers, are they queuing up to get you guys to come out here and plant their waterways?
I guess it's still in its early stages because Labor's released the 1BT sort of 3 years ago, and I guess it's just about trying to find out what funding is available for this stuff, because a lot of all this planting here is funded. It's just farmers trying to get out there and recognise that there is funding available to put native trees in. Each sort of region has different allocations of funding. Up here in Gisborne we're quite fortunate because there's a lot of erosion up here, and so they're giving away 100% funding up here, so yeah, but I think that's about to run out, so yeah, farmers should get in quick. A lot of farmers that we talk to, they're just really busy and there's not a lot of time to write applications for native planting. Their primary focus is their stock and just making sure they can get to the next stage of their growth and their stock and stuff like that.
Where do you see the business going from here?
In the future, I guess we'd like to take on a lot more native planting. We've got a goal to plant 1 million natives. I don't think we're going to get it in the Gisborne or the Hawke's Bay region, so we're willing to just go around the whole country and try and get our target of 1 million natives. It's something we're really passionate about. The first set of natives that we planted about 5 years ago up in Tolaga Bay, it's part of a dock walkway, and just going up there now and seeing these trees, they're massive, they're like 2-3 metres tall now, and just going there, it's quite rewarding just to see, you know, the growth and being able to tell your kids that you had a hand in planting some of these natives.
Willie Hyinger of Farm Care Services in Gisborne.
Next, we're meeting one of the last of the rabbiters. Those hardy souls who stalked high country and backcountry farms, fighting the plagues of rabbits, which had become a serious threat from the 1880s onwards. Max Nelson worked for the Awatere Rabbit Board in the 1960s. A lot of his work was on Molesworth Station. Sally asked him what it was like.
Friggin' hard. Camping in old huts, caravans, freezing in the winter. But I loved it.
What was the scale of the problem you were dealing with?
The rabbits were just out of control. When I first went up there, the landscape was scabweed and practically no growth at all, just rabbit holes, dust, dirt.
There was still stock on there? Trying to graze?
Yep. And once the rabbits were sort of halfway brought under control, and the farmers started to improve with top dressing and subdivision, things started to improve. The grass grew, but it was an ongoing problem with the bunnies.
Well, how did you control them?
Well, basically, when I first went there, it was all aircraft. Basically all aircraft in the winter and quite a bit in the summer. 700 tonne of carrot. Two-thirds of that would be feed and a third was poison.
What sort of poison?
1080. So, yeah, no, it worked very, very well. And then in later years, we got pindone pellets, and they worked even better than 1080 on the rabbits. Didn't work on anything else. It would work on possums, but you had to have massive doses.
So how did you take it around? How did you actually lay it? Because you were talking about a vast area.
Well, 90% of it was probably aircraft, helicopters and fixed wing. You had to know what population of rabbits were there for a start, and then in your brain you'd work out, which I haven't got much of, the quantity of carrot or pellets you needed to put out.
Before aircraft, there were other means. What were they doing?
It was all hand, walking. In the later years of motorbikes, but it was all done with horses.
And were you doing that as well?
Yeah, used horses, carting gear for miles, basically on your own, except for the big aerial jobs. There'd be 4 or 5, 6 there. You'd probably spend a week in the backcountry, from go to one hut to the next hut. And if you fell over and got killed or dipped, they wouldn't find you because no one knew where you were.
didn't have locator beacons in those days.
No, nothing.
What was it like? Did you enjoy it?
Of course I did. I wouldn't be doing it. Still doing it. Though their old bones are getting a bit withered, and they don't like the cold, and they're extreme cold now.
Were you doing it in the cold back in the day?
Yep. Winter, deep snow.
So you'd be trudging along with your horse
yep.
in the snow?
Yep.
And then you'd just be scattering the pellets as you went, or would you?
Not so much the pellets. It would be, in the winter, we used carrot, and we also used raspberry jam. Because the briars were ripe and the rabbits fed on the briar, they quite liked the raspberry jam.
So how did you put the jam out? On toast?
Yeah, of course, for a toaster. No, we had a jam gun, and we turned over a little sod of dirt and put a little, about half your thumb size, piece of jam.
Popped it back in the earth?
Yep, on top.
On top?
On top of the little divot you made. And rabbits came along, and if they didn't eat it, well, you just didn't carry on. So they were fed twice, three times, before the poison went out.
So what was the success rate?
Oh, it was done on low-density rabbits. So, yeah, no, it worked very well.
So then you moved into the aircraft, so that would have been able to you notch it up a tremendous amount.
Yeah, it made a hell of a difference. Well, it was pretty damn hard work, especially at minus 15 in the mornings. Minus 17s, I think it used to get up to somewhere. I remember the vapour coming off and the ice on the wings. And
what sort of aircraft were they?
They were, it went back to, I didn't get involved with the Tiger Moths, but they weren't far behind or in front behind me. They were Piper Cubs, Ag Wagons and Pawnees, and then the big Fletchers came in. Very, very uncomfortable, especially the Cessnas. Then the big Hopper behind you or in front. So it was pretty crammed in there, and it was my job to inspect all the land, work out where the poisons were to go, and sit in the aircraft and tell the pilot where to go.
With all this work with poison, were you wearing special equipment?
No, there was nothing special those days. We had gloves, but as soon as you got a stone in the big carrot cutters, you had to take them off because you couldn't operate in there. So you got covered in 1080.
How's that affected you now?
I don't know. You say.
You look pretty fit to me. Any health issues?
No, 1080's blown all out of proportion, really. I know it does a lot of damage to different things, but it's still a good poison and it's very safe to use.
You didn't have any qualms about using it?
No. Go home at night, covered in 1080. Have a shower. The water would run green. No, never worried. We used arsenic. That was a different story altogether because that was a powder and very dangerous because it communicates in your system. It'll kill you in the end. Strychnine gave that a fair bit of respect. It was instant death, a bit like cyanide.
How did it change when you were using the aircraft? How much more headway did you make in tackling the rabbit problem?
It made one hell of a difference. You could cover so much more land. You were getting a lot of bait onto the ground, and if you got the right time of the year for the right bait, it was very successful. The harder the winter, the better the success. And with the pin-dome pellets, it was the same winter. And the pin-dome pellets, I think we got around sort of 98-99% kills on some of the blocks.
What did you do with all the dead rabbits?
Just leave them there. When there's thousands of them. By the time you pick up a few thousand, they're probably rotten.
I've seen old movie, old film of some of the rabbiters just taking the skins and
yes.
drying them off.
The old rabbiters used to get paid, I don't know, threepence a skin. So really, basically, they were farming because that was their income.
But you didn't need to do that. You were paid.
No,
just
we
to
were
kill.
Paid. That's when the rabbit boards were formed. We got paid, so it didn't matter if you killed 50,000 rabbits or two rabbits. And if it rained, you didn't work, but you still got paid.
So you still work today in pest control. Is it all to do still with rabbits or other pests?
No, I haven't got my licences now. So I go back to Molesworth now and do the ferrets.
How bad is that problem?
They were quite bad. I don't know what they're like at the moment, but for a start, I was catching 400... 401 was the biggest 3 months I had up there. And now I'm roughly 4,500 ferrets I've taken off Molesworth.
How do you do it?
Traps with boxes. The best places are roads, culverts, bridges, buildings and all that sort of stuff. Once you get out into the big open spaces, it's hit and miss.
And sometimes you're in the back country?
Yeah, not so much these days. I like my comforts.
So how have you seen the pest situation change at Molesworth over the time you've been there?
Well, things were pretty chronic and it was poison, poison, poison for many, many years, as you know. And then the Kalinga virus arrived. And that practically annihilated the rabbits in Marlborough. I know there's still rabbits here, but it made one hell of a difference. We haven't poisoned, or any major poisoning, for, 20 years? Well, there's still rabbits, but and there always will be. But they're nowhere near like they were. And every year, three times a year, the virus comes through. As long as it doesn't jump host.
What about possums?
Oh, I catch a few. No, I gave that's too hard of work.
Do you do anything with the skins of the ferrets?
No, they're all buried. Because they're full of TB, I bring them back and bury them.
TB's been a problem at Molesworth, hasn't it? Yeah. And it still is.
Yeah, the ferrets have got it, the possums have got it. Hedgehogs, and I have heard reports of hares. The deer have got it, the pigs have got it, and the cats have got it.
Let's talk about Molesworth, because you've had such a long connection with the place, living there for all those years. Did you ever get into any sticky times on your own out there in those huts in the high country?
Oh, yeah, several. You certainly learn to look after yourself. I got stuck on a big steep face in the middle of winter. Couldn't go forwards, couldn't go backwards.
What'd you do?
I just quietly sat down and just crept and crept and crept. It was just like sandpaper I was walking on.
Did you have your horse or any dogs?
No, I was on foot this time. And I've often thought that if I ever slid and went, that no one would have found me because they didn't know where I was.
Yeah. What about staying in some of those old huts, those old cob cottages? Did you do that much?
Yes, I stopped in most of the old tin huts in the Arrowtree Valley.
Pretty chilly in the winter.
Freezing.
How did you manage?
Absolutely. Oh, I had your sleeping bag, and you just lay there, and if you moved, you shivered. And you prayed that daylight would come pretty soon.
And what about food?
Milk powder, sugar, a wee bit of flour, and a couple of spuds. And a lot of the times, the deer cullers used to leave venison steaks hanging up in the dark corners. They'd smoke it and then hang it up. And, of course, we always had a little bit of fresh meat. Take the hard skin off, crust, fry that up. There'd be a fry pan and a billy. That's about all. The first time I went out with my boss, who was Pat Millard, I had everything in my pack except the kitchen sink. And we went for bloody miles. I think it was about a 4-day trip from one hut to the other. The next time I went, I had absolutely bugger all. Sleeping bag and a bit of tucker.
You'd be going up some pretty steep slopes.
Yeah, a lot of pack tracks. We used to follow the pack tracks a wee bit. Yeah, a lot of steep country. But you were fit in those days.
Are you still fit?
No. Far from it.
You didn't mind the solitary life, though?
No, I loved it. Yeah, I still do. I prefer to be on my own.
What did it teach you, your job?
Look after yourself, I think. Don't panic. No use panicking.
Max Nelson, still going strong. Age 76 this month. He lives on the coast just out of Blenheim now, but will go in and spend a few months trapping again on Molesworth this winter. When he's not trapping, he's up at the crack of dawn salmon fishing or whitebaiting. You can't keep a good man down.
Hi, I'm Clint Meyer from Fire Dragon Chilies in the far north, and you're listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
Cosmo Kentish Barnes is in North Canterbury now to talk hemp with Jamie Engelbrecht from Mainland Hemp. He's checking out a crop that's not far off being harvested.
So we are standing in a field of hemp in Culverton, or just out of Culverton, on the Smiths farm. So, reason we're here is the Smiths grow 20 hectares of hemp for us and have for the second year now. And from that hemp, we're basically getting the seed and processing it into a bunch of raw hemp materials, which are then going to retail.
Now, there's quite a strong, pungent, sweet smell coming from the hemp here.
Yep, no, there's a very distinct smell to it, and so that's something called the terpenes in the flower. And yeah, it was probably only about a month ago you would actually see a whole heap of pollen floating throughout the paddock as well while the males were doing their things. But as you can see, the male plants now are a bit more yellow and have done their bit, and now it's the female's time to shine to produce the seed.
So is there no THC in these hemp plants?
Virtually none. So we've got to test them, and they've got to be below 0.3% THC. Last year, I think we tested them all, and we didn't have one above 0.05% THC. So nothing basically. And that's testing the leaf as well, which would actually have higher THC than what the seed would have. So.
Now the hemp's growing well this year. It's about 1.8 metres high.
Yep. So, we've got a really good crop. As you can see, it's quite uniform throughout the paddock. So I think what is really good about this is the seed density too. You can see that there's a lot of plants per square metre, and we're quite optimistic that we're going to get quite a good harvest this year.
And so what variety are you using here?
So this is a variety called CRS1. So we've used CRS1 for the last 2 years now. It's a seed producing variety, so we're not so interested in the fibre as such with this. It's just more for seed yield, so it seems to give good seed yield and be pretty resilient as well.
Mm. Why aren't you interested in the fibre producing varieties?
Yep, so at the moment we're just sort of focusing on one thing and one thing first. I suppose within the seed, you're producing oil, protein, we're doing a high percentage protein, we're doing hemp hearts, so there's quite a mixture of products already within that. So we're just sort of taking the approach that we want to try and do one thing and do one thing well. And when you're looking at the cultivar that you want, you're essentially selecting for seed, or you're selecting for a fibre crop, or you can get a hybrid as well. But to be honest, we're probably just not really set up in terms of the fibre side of it at the moment. In saying that, when we harvest this crop, we are left with a lot of fibre, so we are still looking at solutions for that. And what we did last year was we baled some of it, and they've actually been using it for garden mulch, which has proved to be really, really, really good. So
you can use literally all of the plant?
Yep, no, you can. It's they call it the plant of 25,000 uses. I haven't personally counted them all myself, but it's, when you do start getting into it, there is a heap of uses. And I think as the industry matures and as people try more things, then those amount of uses will only continue to improve and be used better, I reckon.
There is a seed processing facility on the farm as well. It looks like it's pretty new. We can see it from here across the paddocks of hemp.
Yep, absolutely. So the silos that we can see over there are part of the drying plant. So it's one of the keys when you get the crop off is that you want to be harvesting it at sort of mid 20% moisture, but you've got to very rapidly get that down to about 8 or 9%. Otherwise, you're going to come into some trouble and potentially some combustion. So the Smiths have put in the drying plant themselves, and then in the containers around it is where we do the processing of our oil, protein and hearts.
So you can do that all here on farm?
So you can do it all here on farm, so it's pretty awesome to be able to come out here, and certainly nice to be able to balance being in the office a few days a week and come out here and get the hands dirty as well.
What's your background, Jamie? How and why did you get into growing hemp?
Yeah, so my background, I grew up on a sheep and beef farm down in Waimate, South Canterbury. So grew up on the land, have always had a strong interest in farming, and probably always thought that I would do something to do with farming. I went away to Lincoln University and studied commerce and agriculture there, and at the time met a fellow called Brad Lake. From there, I went away to ASB. So I've been rural banking for about the last 5 years, just finished up at Christmas, and coming to do the hemp thing full time. So in my time meeting Brad Lake at university, and then he actually worked for ASB as well, we sort of got talking and catching up, over a beer, and he came up with this idea, said he was looking at starting a brand with hemp for hemp food. So sort of piqued my interest a bit, and as we went on, we sort of decided, well, yeah, actually, I think there is a lot of merit in this. And obviously, the laws were just changing in December 2018. So when Brad and the co-founder, Brendan, started up the company and started to get a bit of traction with it, we decided, well, if you're producing these hemp products, why don't we have a crack at growing it exactly. ourselves?
Yeah. So you started Mainland Hemp.
Yeah, so Mainland Hemp was born. So Brad, talking to myself, and then you have five others in the crew as well. So we've got Sam Smith, whose parents' farm we're on here at the moment. So he's sort of got a fitter welding background and also sort of events coordination. We've got Ben Crawford, who is an agronomist. Dave Pringle, who's also an ASB rural manager and sort of doing the fronting of it. And then obviously Brad and Brendan. So yeah, it's sort of... A crew who's got, I guess, a unique skill set, but all works together pretty well.
So. Very handy. And I guess the unifying thing is that you all see the potential in hemp.
I think everyone's pretty excited to be working with it, and it's sort of one of those products that you don't feel like you have to go out there and really sell it based on stuff that you don't believe in, because it's amazing how often you can start talking to someone and they'll actually bring up, hey, I've been using the oil now for a couple of months and it's really helped my back and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think everyone's just pretty excited about, you know, what the future will hold for it.
In terms of growing the crop, what are the key challenges you face?
Yeah, so key challenges are probably early on just to get establishment. It doesn't really like wet feet, so if you can get into free-draining soils and get their water on early, then it will generally out-compete anything. Sort of getting it through to the first 30 days is probably pretty key, at which point you sort of give it a second lot of fertiliser and it's no catching it from there. Last year, probably just had a couple of issues with hail damage early on that was potentially going a wee bit early, and just sowing rates, so... We sowed a bit thicker this year, which seems to have worked well, just looking at the health of the plants out there. Birds were a significant challenge for us last year, and hence this year we've sort of looked to plant in bigger areas, because we found that in smaller areas, and particularly, you know, where it was close to shelter belts, and that birds really got into the seed as it got close to harvest. So.
And for the Smiths, are the returns per hectare as good as, say, sheep and beef?
Yeah, I mean...
Because that's what I guess this land would have been used for.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose when you look at returns for sheep and beef, and they're certainly not linear, and it will depend on year to year. But, I mean, with any crop, it's always yield that will drive return. So I think if this crop can go 1,000 kgs to the hectare or better, then it is going to be a very competitive return. And particularly, sort of not one or the other here as well, because it's actually used in a rotation. So a lot of this land came out of fodder beet from last winter, which livestock was grazed on. And then it was left fallow for a bit. The hemp has been sown, so this will be coming off sort of mid-March, and then you've actually got the opportunity still to go back into a permanent pasture or something then. So it's not necessarily one or the other. It's it's just fitting it into your farming system, and the versatility is a real bonus, I think.
So potentially a great rotational crop.
Yeah, absolutely.
So can farmers contact you at Mainland Hemp and discuss the possibility of growing 15 or 20 hectares?
Yeah, no, like I'm more than happy to have a yarn to anyone that wants to look at doing it. If I'm realistic at the moment, we've probably got enough growers for what we need to do and our seed requirements, and growers that are, you know, happy to grow with us. But that being said, you know, we certainly hope to get to a point where we are looking for more land in the not too distant future and that. But yeah, if anyone is interested in growing their own and looking at us doing some contract pressing, then that's something that we'd definitely be open to.
So how much land have you got in hemp in total at the moment?
So this season we've done about 70 hectares. So, so that's spread across the Hiranui and mid-Canterbury. So
that's a lot of seed.
It is a lot of seed, and particularly when basically all of our seed is going into end products. And I think that's what's quite cool about our value chain, is basically from the seed going into the ground and then going through into our retail brands. So the Brothers Green, Kawaka, and soon to be Ritual and Rise, a hemp-based supplement.
In terms of the ability to grow hemp, do you need to purchase a licence? How does it work?
Yep. So, to grow it, all our growers have to get a licence, and they just need to renew that annually. So, and same with us as processors, we need to get a licence for that as well, to handle the seed and keep a register of it.
Have you found that there's been some resistance from farmers about growing hemp because of its link to marijuana?
I think talking to people, I don't think there is a lot of resistance out there, or not so much anymore. I think most people are genuinely interested in what we're doing, and you know, as people in the industry, it's, you know, it's up to us to keep educating in that as well. And we're actually running a field trip out here on Saturday the 20th and Sunday the 21st of this month. So we're going to put on a couple of buses from Christchurch and take anyone out, you know, urban or rural, that wants to see the hemp crop and learn a wee bit more about it. So you know, so that's just another opportunity for some education. And we did it last year, and yeah, it was a pretty awesome day out. And I think just to see people's faces, you know, to be out in the hemp crop, and you know, as you say, with the smell of it and all the rest of it, and particularly when you start to dive into all the uses, yes, of it, it really captures people's imagination. And whether that's on the food side of it, clothing, building houses, I think generally, you know, there's something there for everyone.
I was mentioning to someone that I was coming up to see you here, and he wondered if there is potential to make biofuels out of hemp here in New Zealand.
Yeah, I'm certainly not an expert on that one. I think there probably would be, but it would be just how, you know, how efficient it can be at the end of the day. I mean, other things that I've had people say to me is, oh, can you please make a silage wrap that's biodegradable? And, yeah, I mean, the amount of times that I've heard that, I think that would be something awesome. So that's where I think working with some of the local universities and putting some research projects to some smart students, I think, yeah, we're definitely keen to keep doing that, and, you know, seeing what different avenues that we can go into.
So you mean instead of wrapping a bale of silage in the plastic that it normally comes in, you have it wrapped in the rather strong hemp fibre, which of course would biodegrade.
Yeah.
Great idea.
So I think that'd be awesome, man. And yeah, I think any farmer would agree that, you know, because no one likes leftover solid wrap, but you know, at the moment it serves a purpose for something that you need.
Brad Lake has just turned up at the farm. He's a founding member of hemp food company The Brothers Green. And as Jamie's already mentioned, he's also part of the Mainland Hemp family.
It was a pretty interesting afternoon in the middle of 2017 when I talked about growing hemp up here in North Canterbury, and there was not even a drying facility up here for crops, let alone any hemp being grown. And to be standing here now, start of 2021, we've got a hemp facility here, a full drying plant that's not just for hemp but for a range of other small seeds. And to be looking out the Murray foothills as their feet are covered in hemp is quite spectacular. And it certainly goes to show that when you're willing to put your balls on the line and take a big risk, that these things can pay off. And I think it's a real credit to Sam and his family for, you know, helping us a lot with putting this facility in place and bring something new to this district that hasn't been seen before.
Mm. Jamie was saying that the plants that you're growing at the moment are a seed-producing variety. Would you consider in the future growing hemp for fibre as well as seed?
Absolutely. I mean, for us, it's really about ensuring we get as much hemp in the ground. That's always been sort of one of our key principles. And, you know, for me, I think the fibre space is incredibly exciting. I think the opportunity to look at not just fibre blends, but the use for industrial building materials, and people are looking at carbon composites now. They're putting the carbon into 3D printing filament. You know, the potential is massive. It's, you know, nature's strongest natural fibre. And for us, a lot of it is around education. It's really about making sure the consumer is aware of not just the opportunities within hemp, but also in the products that it could potentially compete with, or, you know, it can outdo in its capacity to make a sustainable fibre, but also, you know, replace certain levels of building material and replace plastics. And that's really what we want to be a part of. And for me, it's just about bringing the infrastructure here and making sure that we've got that available in New Zealand, so that it gives farmers confidence that if they want to grow a crop of fibre, that they've got an outlet for it somewhere for it to get processed, and that the IP and the PD is being done to have a place for that fibre to go.
Mm-hmm. So at the moment, there aren't many places that can process fibre on a commercial scale.
No, there's been a very exciting last couple of years in the hemp industry, not just for the food side but for the fibre side. So NZ Yarn and Carfields have got together, and along with New Zealand Hemp Farm, and they've got together and brought in a decorticator, which is the machinery that's needed to separate out the herd and the fibre from the fibre crop within hemp. And so that's been a couple of years in their pipeline, and I think we're only a couple of weeks away now from that being operational. And so it looks like from now on we're going to have the ability at least to process hemp fibre as a crop as well as a food. So it'll be really exciting the next couple of years to see where that fibre side of the hemp business goes.
And I guess there's a sustainability angle to growing hemp that has lots of marketing appeal as well.
Absolutely. I mean, if we purely look at this climate change argument and the carbon issue, well, I believe farmers are going to be our greatest tool in doing the jobs we need to do to sequester that carbon. And for me, hemp is the ultimate crop. It sequesters 4 times more carbon than a pine forest per hectare and doesn't take up very valuable hill country space that's currently being overtaken with pine plantations. And on top of that, it's a higher user of nitrogen, so able to utilise and capture a lot of nutrients that are potentially lost to pasture species. So, you know, our ability to mitigate some of the runoff and nitrogen leaching is now starting to be looked at pretty seriously. And for me, this is just another tool in a farmer's toolbox and a cropping option that, you know, we know is going to be sequestering carbon, it's supplying, you know, plant-based nutrients, and the diversity of products that it can provide and the economic potential is massive. So for me, it just ticks so many boxes and really puts a stake in the ground from the farming community that we can shine the light on all aspects of society and their environmental impact and show what other parts of society need to pick up their act and be a collective in how we proceed forward into a more sustainable future.
How challenging has it been to get consumers to buy hemp products?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I guess we had our first farmers market in June of 2018, and that day, you know, we were asked a range of questions from, you know, can we smoke your t-shirt to, you know, is this going to get my kids high? And so we really started off on the back foot, and, you know, it was credit to a range of pretty pioneering people in the hemp industry in New Zealand who even got hemp oil to be legal, and it's certainly a privilege to sort of be in the timeline we're at now where seed is actually legal as well. So, you know, I guess it's been a hard one because you're seeing the government and the Ministry of Health continuing to sort of model hemp as being very much in need of control and regulation, which doesn't do a lot for the public perception of hemp and its usefulness and what it's good for. So it's really just about making sure that we have that sovereignty between the two plants.
How is your business, The Brothers Green, going, and are you making enough money to continue your innovations?
Yeah, I guess it's been, last year was a really steep learning curve for us. You know, we had a lot of product in the pipeline ready to go, and one of our biggest customers is, you know, is the supermarkets, particularly foodstuffs, and with COVID coming along, it put a halt on any new products going into the supermarkets and certainly changed a lot of our strategy moving forward as we sort of, you know, I guess batten down the hatches and just saw what was going to come. And you know, lucky enough now, we're still standing and, you know, things are looking pretty good now. We're seeing a lot more interest. We're still continuing with our product development. We've got a new product coming out, which is an apricot quinoa hempy bar, which is a, you know, plant-based snack bar, which is utilising cannabis-grown quinoa as well as our hemp seeds. So we're really excited to bring that to the market. And so we're having a lot of interest from some potential export markets that we've picked up, and we just really have to, you know, obviously have the volumes there to be able to fit those requirements and also just understand the marketing strategies and, you know, where we want to sit. So, you know, we're really working really hard on our education piece and our brand story and really telling this paddock to plate value chain so that, you know, those overseas customers can get real confidence that the price they're paying for New Zealand hemp is worth it, and on top of that, it's a brilliant product.
Mm. And so what are you going to be doing here on the farm today?
So what we're going to be doing today, I think, is actually doing our first batch of 400 kgs of hemp protein powder. This is produced by cold pressing the de-hulled hemp seed and then milling it down. So it'll be an exciting afternoon. It's sort of our first batch we've done, and we're hoping to get that product together and get it available to the market sort of start of April, which is going to be really exciting. But, yeah, it's just nice to yeah, obviously with mainland here, being able to get new products out and trial and test some new processes and products we can produce out of the hemp seed.
That was Brad Lake ending that story from a farm near Culverden in North Canterbury where hemp is grown and processed for seeds. Cosmo was also talking to Jamie Engelbrecht, who says Culverden's a good fit for hemp as it's situated at 42 degrees south. The Emerald Triangle in Northern California, the largest hemp-producing region in the US, is a similar distance from the equator. And if you'd like to attend the field day in Culverden that Jamie mentioned, we'll put a link on our webpage, or otherwise go to the Tāpapa NZ Facebook page for more details.
And that's our show for this week, but remember you can listen to stories again on the Country Life podcast. Better still, why not subscribe? You can do that on our webpage or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're also on Facebook and Twitter @RNZ Country. That's it for now. Thanks for joining us. Cheerio.
Bye now.